Good evening, everyone, from Yerushalayim Meir Kodesh. Tonight, we're going to discuss, as we're up to the Sugya of Rechamim Zganakan and Mitzachim, we're going to discuss the aspects of Tumah Tahara. As usual, we blend it with the archaeological findings and the Makaris of Chazal. What do we see? What does the archaeological evidence teach us? What does it add to what we already know from Chazal? So, it's not direct linked solely to the Sugya of Rechamim Zganakan, we're talking about Tahara in general. Tahara and Tumah is a very special thing. It's not a thing that is not tangible, but it dictates, of course, in all times, it dictated people's lives, where they ate, where they walked, what they touched. Everything was, everyone was very Tahara conscientious in those days, especially at the end of the second Beis Hamikdash, as we shall see. We have the Hebrew source page. I hope you have it printed out for you. We're going to start with Gemara in Sanhedrin, Daf Tzadik Daled on the base, which is Hebrew source 3.1. And the Gemara says like this. It's talking about the time of Sancheiriv and Chizkiyahu. When Chizkiyahu, King Chizkiyahu, was threatened by the mighty empire, Ashur, and Sancheiriv the king was coming, so Chizkiyahu knew that he didn't really stand any chance. He didn't stand any chance in a physical war, but if he had the Siyata Shemaya, then he'll be able to be victorious. That's what happened in the end. The haste happened, and Sancheiriv's army was wiped out outside Yerushalayim. So the pasuk says, "V'chubal ol mipnei shemen." Yitzchak Nafcha, and this is the quote: "Chubal ol shel Sancheiriv neishmona shel Chizkiyahu." The oil, the yoke of Sancheiriv was broken, was damaged because of the oil of Chizkiyahu. She'adolik b'vata kinesis b'vata midrashos. The oil which Chizkiyahu used to light up the b'vata kinesis b'vata midrashos. Ma'osa, what did he do? Na'at Chayav pesach beis hamedrash. He put a sword at the entrance to the Beis HaMedrash, whoever does not osik in Torah will be killed with his sword. They checked from Don in the north till Be'er Sheva in the south, and they didn't find anyone who was ignorant. From Kvas to Antipas, which is the extended borders of Yehuda, which is the southern part of the country, and they didn't find even a tinok or a tinokes, an infant, a young child, a man or a woman that were not baki in Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara. When it comes to the laws of Hilchos Tumah V'Tahara, it's not a thing just for the adults, for the males, the females, everyone's got to know what it is, whatever you touch. If you touch something, it could become tummy, and then you run into problems. So everyone in that generation was so trained that even the young children were baki in Dinei Tumah V'Tahara. And that generation says even if a person will have lots of material wealth, he will ignore the material world for the spiritual world. We'll see how Chizkiyahu put the emphasis on the Tumah V'Tahara, and this is the way that he was able to overpower Sancheiriv. As we'll see, in the second Beis Hamikdash period and on, we do not have, we have plenty of evidence about Tumah V'Tahara. From the first Beis Hamikdash, we have very little. I say very little, if I would have been here a year ago, a little more, I would have said none. But, again, we have to remember what archaeological evidence is and what the lack isn't. In other words, in later periods, they're using the building mikvahs, etc. In earlier periods, when they weren't so sophisticated, so the people used mikvahs. The mikvahs could have been a pool which was filled up from the town well or something like that. It wasn't that everyone had their own private mikvah. So, for example, in all of Eir David, from the first Beis Hamikdash, all of Eir David, all we have is a bunch of houses. Few houses, we don't really find anything that can be constituted as a mikvah. We do find in Sefer Shmuel that David HaMelech walked on his roof and he saw Bathsheba, that she was going to the mikvah, v'imitz kadeshes mitumasa, but of course it doesn't describe what type of mikvah this was. Now I'd assume in Yerushalayim you have the Gihon Spring. The Gihon Spring was also Mayim Chayim. live water. So nearby, there could have been a pool that filled up from the Gihon Spring, and that served as a local mikvah. Recently, they did find a pool like that, a little earlier, from a little earlier period. True, but I'm saying it's a very simple solution for Yerushalayim. We also know that in Yerushalayim, there are a bunch of springs that have been sealed up by Chizkiyahu during his preparations for some hair. So it was more than just one spring. A Zav had to go to a mikvah Mayim Chayim, and there was such in Yerushalayim. But in the last year and a half, a very interesting cave was found in a place called Tzova. Tzova is in the Judean hills near today Mevaseret Tzion. And this cave was found to be a cave where there was a pool of water from the days of the first Beis HaMikdash. And they found scores, I don't remember the exact number, of oil lamps from the first Beis HaMikdash period. Unfortunately, as a lot of things happen in this country, and they find that it's an archaeological thing, they're already diverted to non-Jewish sources and decided that it serves some non-Jewish source in the end of the second Beis HaMikdash and on, but that's all speculation. But what we did find is the fact that in the first Beis HaMikdash this was used, and it was used for Tahara, and all its people came to this pool, and the oil lamps from that period are the clear evidence that we're talking about the first Beis HaMikdash period. So that is, as I said, to date, that's the only thing that we can actually pinpoint to the first Beis HaMikdash, and the only way we could do that is again by the oil lamps. Otherwise it would be another pool which we really couldn't see in or out. So that's the evidence that we have from the first Beis HaMikdash, as we said, a little, but again, that doesn't prove that there wasn't other stuff. It was just didn't get as sophisticated as it did towards the end of the second Beis HaMikdash. In the second Beis HaMikdash, things changed drastically. We have the Gemara in Masechah Shabbos. That's in the Hebrew source, page 2.3. Shabbos and Gimel. Tanya, Rabbi Shimon ben Elazar Omer, Bo'orei at Heichon Parts at Arab Yisrael. The Gemara is talking about the Yudchas Dvarim, the 18 things which are passing the Aloch is like Shammai, the Aloch is like Beis Shammai, over Beis Hillel. And the Gemara says, Bo'orei at Heichon Parts at Arab Yisrael. Come and see how far, how strong Tahara became, that they made so many limits, they made so many gzeiros, so many things to prevent any cases of tumor. Now, if we're talking about that time period, we're talking about the end of the second Beis HaMikdash period. Hillel and Shammai are 100 years before the Churban of the second Beis HaMikdash, and which is about the year 30 BCE. And Beis Shammai and Beis Hillel are the Talmidim who follow afterwards. Interestingly, archaeologically speaking, that is when we see a lot evidence of a lot more of Tahara. But let's start even before. The earliest mikvahs, other than that one we mentioned in Tzova, the earliest mikvahs date back to the Hashmonai period. A couple of words about a mikvah. How we define a mikvah, how we determine that something is a mikvah. Tell you the story. In the early 60s, Yigael Yadin, the archaeologist, was excavating the famous mountain of Masada. And Yigael Yadin was not a very learned person, but he had a lot of respect for the Makotas. And one of the people on his expedition was a person by the name of Nachem Magen, a religious person. And when they were cleaning out a basement of some room, and Nachem Magen looks at it, he says, "Hey, this is a mikvah." So Yadin says, "Well, what's a mikvah?" So Nachem Magen starts explaining to him what a mikvah is. So Yadin was like so amazed. Here's an opportunity to actually connect an archaeological find with the Makoros. He right away brought down the top two experts on Makoros from Yerushalayim, of Mintzberg, that was at Tzal Festival a few years ago, and another Rav. He describes this in detail in his book on Masada. He's so excited how these people come with their long black coats in the middle of the summer, and they're not interested in any of the Herodian construction, whatever. All they want to see is the mikvah, and they go in, and they measure the mikvah, and sure enough, after a while, they have to take the measurements. It's indeed a kosher mikvah. Yadin is so fascinated by the story. As I said, he gives it a whole chapter over there in his book. Today, the excitement is a lot less because we already know what mikvahs are. It turns out that mikvahs had been found even 60 or 70 years before that in Tel Gezer, which is near the city of Ramla. An archaeologist by the name of Callister already discovered mikvahs from the Hashmonite period, but he had no idea what it was. So you write them as pools or roofed pools or whatever, but that's about it. So what actually determines a mikvah? And the second question is, what differentiates a mikvah from a typical water system? And three, why are mikvahs so important? We know in the halacha, what a mikvah's got to be, a mikvah's got to be from rainwater. It cannot be mayim shuvim. It cannot be drawn water. It's got to be from rainwater. It's got to be a certain size. This is interesting because when we talk about the first person mikdash, we don't have these devices that are mikvahs. The Gemara says, and I quote here from the Hebrew source, page 1.1, the Gemara says, Shani Shiva the midrabanani, the iser, the psul of a mikvah, if it's drawn water, is only drabanan. Meaning midaraisa, even a mayim shuvim, a mikvah mayim shuvim is also kosher. Tosfos says that doesn't mean if the entire thing is mayim shuvim, it's just part of it. But the point is that there was a time midaraisa before Chacham made gzera that they were mekel that it was more lenient than it is today, and they could use mayim shuvim. So it could be in those days there was no need for such devices that they developed later on when Chacham actually put the limits and said you cannot have mayim shuvim. That's a possibility. But we'll leave it at that. The mikvahs and by Sheni are all mikvahs which are meant to gather rainwater. That's number one. The rainwater, as we know from the Mishnah mikvahs, I don't have it here, but the Mishnah work, the water would come usually from the steps. It would come down into the mikvah from the steps. We see that in mikvahs in a place called Susia, which is south of Hebron, or from the roof of the house. Now remember, when we talk about mikvahs and we find mikvahs, I'll show you a picture of a mikvah soon, shortly, mikvahs are in the basement of the house. Very often all you find is a mikvah and nothing else. I often take people on tours and I usually ask the kids, if you come and you want to know if a house is a Jewish house or not, how would you know that? So the kids, the first thing the kids say is the mezuzah. Well, that's true. Today you look around, you see a mezuzah, you know it's a Jewish house. But in archaeology, very seldom do you find a wall that's standing so high that would even be the place where the mezuzah sat, let alone to find the mezuzah. The parchment, of course, since then, 2,000 years, didn't survive. But the basement, the mikvah, is what is the answer we look for. If you find a mikvah, they know it's a Jewish house. Because the concept of a mikvah does not appear in any other civilization, only in the Jewish civilization. So as we said, what constitutes a mikvah? So the Gemara says, and I didn't bring the source over here, sorry, the Gemara says, Rochatz b'mayim, mayim shekol gufay ola behen. Water that his entire body can immerse himself in. And how much is that? Ama alama barum shalosh amos. V'shira chachomim mikveh arbaim sekel. 40, in other words, 3 cubic amos, basically. And chachomim shalosh that is the measurement of a 40 sekel. 3 cubic amos, enough for the height of a person to fit in. And, okay, a person's a little taller than 3 amos, so this is very discussed. There's numerous places in Yuma, whatever. 40 seah of rainwater. 40 seah of rainwater. And another condition that's necessary is the water must be stable. It cannot be moving. If the water is zeichlin, as lush in the Mishnah Mekvahs, if it's zeichlin, then it's not a kosher mikvah. Unless if it's a river or an ocean, that's a separate thing. But in a regular mikvah, the water cannot be moving. And in order to prevent the water from moving, today, for example, when they make a mikvah, they pour it with concrete, usually one block, not in 2 shots, so that the water does not have a chance to seep. There's no cracks in the concrete, and the water cannot seep in. And periodically, the mikvahs check to see if the water is seeping out at too high of a pace, then it's a problem with the kashrus of the mikvah. All the mikvahs that we label our mikvah as a mikvah are, again, have to be the proper size, which is 40 seah, and have a special plaster, hydraulic plaster, which is made to prevent the water from seeping in. Now, every water system had this plaster also. You don't want to store water for the summer, and then 2 months later you come and find out that the water is not there. Something like the Israeli government did in the Negev years ago when they wanted to make a special oil depot to store oil in time of need, so they stored it in a place, and the oil very quickly seeped into the rocks, you know, and disappeared. So you don't want that to happen, and so you always had this hydraulic plaster. So what differentiates the mikvah from the typical water system which every other civilization had. You go to Shalayim, a house for many period had a water system. It rains here 3-4 months a year. The rest of the year is dry. You better store water in the winter months for the summer. The answer is usually the staircase. In other words, if every water system had a staircase, a narrow staircase, which was meant to go down, and they usually could draw the water from the bucket from the top, but at the end of the summer you wanted to clean it out, so there was a way to go down and clean it out. A very narrow staircase. A mikvah, on the other hand, is a very wide staircase, clearly meant for people to use it commonly to go up and to go down. The mikvahs were very often in caves, as we know from numerous sources. We know this from the Mishnah in Mishnayos and Mikvos, and we also know this from the Gemara in Shabbos, and I'm sorry we didn't put that source here either, but the Gemara in Shabbos tells us the story. The Chachamim made a takana that if a person bathed himself in Mayim Sheuvim, meaning in drawn water, not in mikveh water, so then he becomes tamei and he cannot eat truma. Why did they make such a gezeirah? What was the purpose of a person using that? He was tar. And he went into a place of Mayim Shuvim, he took a shower, he becomes tamei, and he cannot, he can no longer eat truma. Why would Chachamim do such a thing, which at first sounds really strange? But the Gemara explains to us that in those days people used to bathe in the mikvah. Now again, it rains only in the winter months. In the summer, there's no rain. And after using such a mikvah for a few months, if there's no supplying of water, so then the water will get pretty filthy and smelly. And in the absence of any other mikvah, people will use it. But of course, people weren't happy and thrilled about it that when they came out, they were not smelling too nicely. So the people started finding a solution. The solution was after they bathed, after they went into the mikvah, they would go and take a bath or a shower and Mayim Shuvim and clean themselves off. There's no problem with that, except that Chachamim were afraid that the end result would be that people would be thinking that what made them tar is not that they went into the mikvah, but that they went into the bath afterwards. So in other words, people forget that the mikvah is what makes them tar, and all they'll do is go to a bath with Mayim Shuvim. And therefore Chachamim made this takana that you cannot use Mayim Shuvim. If a person, a person who bathes in Mayim Shuvim, even after he went to the mikvah, he becomes tamei again. He's got to go into the mikvah another time. So, we see from this again, the situation was not always very easy to replenish the water in the mikvah in the summer months. It got really wasn't that pleasant. How they dealt with it, we'll mention the solutions that I used today. We'll mention the solutions that I used then. But anyway, those are the mikvahs. The mikvahs are a symbol of, again, as I told you, a sign that Jewish people live there. They only exist in Jewish civilization. And basically, wherever we go in the country today where they find mikvahs, they know this place was a Jewish town. The earliest mikvahs, as I said, appear in a city called Gezer, near Ramla, in the Hashmonai palaces near Yericho. They were also the oldest mikvahs. I shouldn't say the oldest mikvahs. The oldest things that scientifically have been identified as a mikvah. And from then on, they start appearing all over the place, in Yerushalayim in particular. The mounds of mikvahs that have been found, specifically around Har HaBayis, unbelievable amounts in Yerushalayim. Houses that have been excavated from the end of the second Mishnah Mikdash. Every house had at least one mikvah, but there are houses over there that were found with 4 to 5 to 7 to 8 mikvahs. The archaeologist who excavated over there, by the name of Nachman Avigad, in his book, he just doesn't understand it. He can't understand why so many mikvahs. The truth is, so far, there's no straight explanation why it was really necessary to have so many, unless these houses were occupied by numerous families and not just one individual family. But again, the house is known as the Herodian Quarter today, underneath Yeshivat HaKotel. There are about 7-8 mikvahs in that house. We don't know why. Again, the water came from the roofs. Some of them very nice mikvahs. The book by Nachman Avigad, The Upper City of Yerushalayim, beautiful book where you can see pictures of those. The people, as we said, their lives are dictated by Tumah and Tahara. There are different levels of Tahara, and a person walking on the street, for example, in Yerushalayim, would have to make sure he didn't bump into someone. If he bumped into someone, and he's on one level of Tahara, and the other person isn't, so he'd become Tahara, he's going to have to go to the mikveh again. So what did they do to avoid that? There's a letter known as the Letter of Aristeas, who was a Greek in the time of the Hellenistic period, which means in the early Second Base English period before the Hasmonaim. And this letter, although the historical authenticity of it is questionable, but in this letter he mentions that the people of Yerushalayim had different streets to go on depending on the level of Tahara they had. So let's see which levels of Tahara the people were. And for that we go to the Hebrew source page, Mishnah in Chagiga 2.4. Chagiga Yudches, Hebrew source page 2.4. The Mishnah says like this: Notam layadayim lechulin olamayser letruma. If a person wants to eat, a person is tahar, but he wants to eat chulin, which means stuff that's not kodesh at all, or maaser. He wants to eat maaser sheni, or truma. He has to wash his hands. Ulekodesh matbilin. If he wants to eat kodesh, he has to tovel his hands. We're talking about where a person's hands are tamei, only the hands became tamei, not the body. That's all sugya in the first parak in Shabbos. So for chulin, for ma'aser, for truma, he can wash his hands with ma'am shuvim. For kodesh, he's got to be tovel his hands in a mikvah. And for chatos, which means if he wants to do something for the paraduma, to touch Eifer paraduma, that is a higher level. In nitmu yadav nitma gufo, if his hands became tamei, so then his body also becomes tamei. Now the Mishnah says, tava lechulin, huchzak lechulin asu lemaisa. If a person went into the mikvah, he was tamei, and he had in mind that he's going to the mikvah to eat chulin, which means stuff that's not kodesh. And he walks out, and now he wants to eat maaser. That's a no-no. The intention of your tevilah will decide how tar you are. So if your intention was to eat chulin, now you want to eat maaser, you have to go into the mikvah again. Tovah lemaaser, ruchzak lemaaser. If he was tovah for maaser, with the intention of eating maaser, so he's muchzak for maaser. Also with truma. He's not allowed to eat truma. Tovah letruma, ruchzak letruma, also lekodesh. If he went into the mikvah with the intention of eating truma, and then now he wants to eat karbanos, no good. He's got to go in again. So it gives us five levels over here. We have chulin, we have maaser, we have truma, we have kodesh, and we have chatas. These are five different levels. And each person usually went on the level that fit him. A Yisrael, there's no reason for him to eat stuff without truma. If he's Yisrael, he's not going to eat truma. So the most he cared was for maaser. But you have people, as the Mishnah goes on and talks about, Bidya Ma'aretz Medes Apushim. Bidya Apushim Medes Lochle Truma. If a person is an Amaretz and he bumps into someone who is careful to eat even Chulin B'tara, now you're not Mechuyiv to. But if you're not eating Kodesh, you can eat even with his tummy. But the people who are Makpin on it, not to eat Chulin B'tumah. So this person is walking on the street and he bumps into someone who's not Makpin, he touches him, so then he becomes tummy. He's going to have to be tovel again. Let's say this person is used to eating chulin b'tahara, and he walks on the street and there's a kohen, and the kohen's used to eating truma, and they bump into each other. The kohen again, the kohen's going to have to go to the mikvah now because he was on a higher level of tahara, and he bumps into someone who was on a lower level, and so on with kodesh, and so on with chatos. Now you have another thing over here, is that a thing called chulin shenasu al taharas truma and chulin shenasu al taharas kodesh, which means a person, let's say he's a kohen and he's used to eating truma. Now in truma it's a higher level of tahara. What do we mean a higher level of tahara? It means that if it's shlishi bituma, and that you're learning the whole sugya now in the sugya of Kenyan's kind of training, if it's shlishi, it was a third from the av, so then in truma it's tamei, but in chulin it's not. Now, a person who eats chulin al taharas truma means that this person is used to eating truma. And he's used to eating truma, and when he's used to eating truma, he knows if it's truma, shlishi, I can't touch. Now he has chulin, he has an apple of chulin. And the apple is shlishi. There's no problem. It's not truma. There's no problem with him eating it. But this person doesn't want to get confused one day Shlishi I could eat, one day Shlishi I can't. So he eats his chulin at the same level as he eats his truma, which means if it's Shlishi he won't eat it because it's considered tamaytim. That's called chulin shenasa taras truma. Likewise, the chulin shenasa taras kodesh, if it's a person, kodesh can become tamay even the fourth revi betuma, as the whole sugya over here, Rabbanis Gan Hakadosh, he dalit. So a person eats altaras hakodesh, that means he will not eat revi betuma even from the chulin because he's used to eating kodesh. Now, why would a person eat altaras hakodesh? The only logic is that the person is used to eating karbanos. If he's not eating karbanos, there's no real reason for him to be makpid to eat his chulin on the level of kodesh. But if the person is used to eating karbanos, so if he's used to eating karbanos, so he wants to be careful and not to be confused. Sometimes yes, yes. Okay, sometimes not okay. He always has his limits. If it's Revi, he doesn't need it. Interesting archaeological evidence is from Masada. In Masada, which we mentioned that the first time that they found the mikvos, they also found lots of pieces of pottery there with names. And besides the names, they also found pieces of pottery that had letters on it or words. And if it had a tuf, for example, the Mishnah in Dumai tells us that if it's tuf, it stands for truma. So in other words, there was truma in this jar. Or tuf mem stands for truma's meiser. Or Dumai. Or tevel. Or stuff like that. A lot of these things that are mentioned in the Mishnah in Masechet Dumai were found on piece of pottery in Masada. Two unique things that were found in Masada are piece of pottery from jars that it talks about dried figs, and it talks about them being kasher in the Taharas HaKodesh. Says these figs, one of them says they're not kasher in the Taharas HaKodesh, and another piece of pottery from another jar said that they are kasher in the Taharas HaKodesh. Now besides the fact that we see something over here that's the same mentioned in Chazal, which is of course interesting in itself to find something straight from Chazal, you see people in Makban Taharas HaKodesh, that also gives us a picture of who these people are. Because if the person is eating on Taharas HaKodesh and he's sitting in Masada and the Beis HaMikdash is already destroyed when they're sitting on Masada, the only reason why he could be eating on Taharas HaKodesh is A, that he must have come from Yerushalayim and he's used to eating Karbanos, and B, is that he hopes that the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt from Meheira, and that's why he's still keeping to what was. Which indeed was the case in Masada. We know the people who came to Masada actually ran away from Yerushalayim. We know from the historian Josephus, and so again, the evidence of people who were eating korbanos who came from Shalim were makbid to eat the chulin al Taharas HaKodesh. All told, in Masada, for example, in the days of Yadin, they identified three mikvaos. Today, we know that there are about seven mikvaos on Masada, while there's someone who insists that he can even give a total of 23 mikvaos on Masada. Depending on exactly how you determine what's a mikvah. Any big pool over there, he says, was a mikvah. Now, again, you can't argue with that. That's what someone told Yadin, the archaeologist, after he was so ecstatic about finding mikvahs. He says, you know, it's going to be a little difficult to find something that's not a mikvah. How are you going to prove something that's not a mikvah? It's going to be more difficult. Because when you think about it, that's indeed true. But then we have at least seven mikvahs on Masada. And if we can go to the pictures, I just want to start showing a few pictures from Masada. An interesting thing on Masada, A, we have to take into account that Masada is a place where the amount of rainwater, is minimal throughout the year. So if you want rainwater for a mikvah and you have to store it, you can have a very little amount. So the fact to have so many mikvahs up there on Masada is an interesting thing in itself. So we'll get back to those. We'll get back to the mikvahs and Masada in a moment. I just want to mention. Okay, we're back. We started with the streets of Yerushalayim. So in this document, known as Aristeas' letter from the Hellenistic period, he mentions that the way to solve the problem in Yerushalayim for people who are on different level of Tahara is they had different streets. Meaning you had Rehov Chulin, and you had Rehov Meiser, Rehov Truma, and Rehov Kodesh, and Rehov Chatas. In other words, people used to walk and cut through the streets there were different streets, and each street was designated for a person who was on a different level of Tahara, and this way you didn't bump into someone else and you avoided problems. We do have a little backing for this from the Mishnah. Again, as I said, the authenticity of this letter, Aristarchus' letter, is questionable, but we do have a Mishnah, Sachem Daf Yutes on the base, which is 2.2 on the Hebrew source page. We quote from a Mishnah in Shkolim. It says, Kolarokim and Tzav Yerushalayim Tahorin Chutz Mishal Shuka Elyon. If a person walks on the street in Yerushalayim and he sees some saliva on the floor, so again, to us, it would not interest us in the slightest. But in those days, it was a big problem, because if the saliva came from a person who was a zav or a zava, so then it's tameh, and a person touches it, he will become tameh. So what is the status? So the Mishnah says, "Kol arokim anemtzah mirushalayim tahorim." Any saliva that's on the shelf is tahor chutz mishal shuka elyon, except in a place called Shuka Elyon, the upper marketplace. According to Josephus, the upper marketplace is talking about the market in the upper city of Yerushalayim today. That's not far from Migdol Davar. But anyway, what do we see from this? We see the people who were tamei, they had a separate place where they were, and they didn't go elsewhere, and therefore you don't have to worry that if you find saliva anywhere else, it's tamei. This kind of backs up what we said in Aristarchus' letter, that that there was separate streets. Okay, again, it just proves that the separate streets for tamei tahara. It doesn't prove there were separate streets for different levels of tahara. But as we said, that might have been a solution. That might have been a way to solve the problem. Tumei tahara in the days of the second base of Mikdash, we mentioned Rav Satar Yisrael, to an extent even became an obsession. It's not very positive, indeed so, but this is what the Gemara tells us. And the Hebrew source page 3.2 tells us, a Gemara in Yom HaChav Gimel HaManal, Tanan Bara. Ma'aseh b'shnei kohanim sh'ushneim shavim ratzim ba'olam ha'kevesh. There were two kohanim who were racing up the ramp. While they were racing up the ramp, they used to have a race. If two kohanim came to do a certain avodah, like to do Truma Sedeshen, to remove the ashes from the Mizbeach, so the kohanim would race up the ramp, and whoever would win would get the honor to do that, do avodah in the Beis HaMikdash. So one of them won, and the guy who lost, the guy who lost was so upset, he took a knife, and he stabbed the other kohen in the heart. Imagine, on the Mizbeach, in the Beis HaMikdash. Amar Rabbi Tzadok, Halmalos Olam. Rabbi Tzadok stood on the steps leading up to the Beis HaMikdash, V'amar Achinu Beis Yisrael. Shimu, Harei Rom, and the Pasuk says, Ki Matzechol Badam of Yotzus Kenecho V'Shevtecho. If you find a dead person, a person who was killed, so then you have to bring an Egla Rufa. Alo mi lavi Egla Rufa. La ir o azars. Who has to bring an Egla Rufa? In this case, the Gemara says, of course, they knew who killed him, so it was really not a din of Egla Rufa, but he just wanted the people to cry. So he said, who has to bring the Egla Rufa, the city, or the Azars? Go call the Ambifchiyu. Everyone started crying. V'avim shel Tinok, the father of this Tinok, of this young one, who had just been murdered, and he sees that his son is still alive, he's still moving, he's not dead yet. The father says, look at that, since his son is still alive, so therefore the sakin, the knife, did not become tummy, because it only becomes tummy when the person is actually dead. And since he's not dead yet, so the knife is tahor. To teach you that in the days of the second Beis HaMikdash, in the end, Taras Kelim was so important, and Shfichus Damim became less, that the people cared more about the Tahara of the Kelim rather than Shfichus Damim. Meaning the father, his son is murdered over here, and all he cares about is whether or not the knife is going to become Tamei or Tahara. So in other words, Chazal, of course, are not saying this for a plus, they're saying this as a minus, but the Tahara in those days became an obsession so much that this is what the father cares about. Not just an individual, it's the father, the son killed, this is what he cares about. Another part of the system that they had, for going up and down, for going different rooms, different streets, for people at Tamei and Tahara. So we have a very interesting Mishnah in Shkolim, and this is in the Hebrew source, page 2.1. Shkolim, Perek Ches, Mishnah Beis. Kol HaKelim HaMutzam Yerushalayim. All the Kelim that are found in Yerushalayim, Derech Yeridel Beis HaTevila Tameh. If they're found on the way down to the Beis HaTevila Tameh. So what has happened? The person walks in, walks going to the mikvah on Erev Pesach, and he finds over there a knife. And this knife, for its obvious purpose, is going to be used in order to cut up the Korban Pesach. And that's why it's around the mikvah, because the person took it to be tovelit. And now he lost it, and someone else finds it. And now he has a question. Is this knife that he found, is it tameh or tameh? Does he have to tovelit again, or can he keep it the way it is? So the Mishnah says like this, Derech Yeridel Beis HaTevila Tameh. If the person found it on the way down, going into the Beis HaTevila, if the person found it going on the way into the mikvah, so then it's tameh. Because if he found it on the way in and the person dropped it there, that means he dropped it before he went into the mikvah. And if he dropped it before he went into the mikvah, so then he wasn't over it, and therefore the kli is tameh. If derech aliyah tahor, but if he found it on the way out of the mikvah, coming up from the mikvah, then it's tahor. Why? Because the way they went down was not the way that they came up. They went down one way and they came down another. Of course, this makes a lot of sense. A person is tameh and he's going to go into the mikvah. And if he comes out and he bumps into the person coming in, he's going to become tameh again. He'll be going into the mikvah the whole day. So they made a simple system, this way in, this way out, and that's how the problem is solved. And indeed, a very interesting thing was found in a lot of mikvahs, not all, and mostly in the Yerushalayim area, but what was found is that the steps leading into the mikvahs had a separation along the steps. And it's fairly evident that the purpose of the separation along the steps is to go down one way and to go up the other way. That is the purpose of the steps, and that's what we see from the mission that they had Derech Yerida and Derech Aliyah. Okay, so the mikvah pictures will be up soon. We have two pictures from a mikvah from Har HaBayis. What's important to see on the picture of the mikvah from Har HaBayis is A, you see the wide steps, as I told you. It's clearly the width of the staircase is the width of the mikvah. In other words, it's meant to be used. It's meant to be used to go up and to go down. And for the public, not for an individual to clean the cistern. And in the middle of it, there's a small stone thing separating. In other words, it's carved out of the rock. When they carved the steps, they clearly left that thing in the middle for the people to walk up and down separately. Now, it doesn't look really that impressive, that separation, but that is a typical separation found in mikvahs. I just mentioned that in a mikvah in Gush Etzion area, south of Yerushalayim, midway between Hebron and Yerushalayim, there's a mikvah with a staircase with a massive wall separating the Derech Yerida and Derech Aliyah. Now, this mikvah was found along the road. There's no settlement nearby. It's found along the road going up to Yerushalayim. So it's believed that that mikvah was used for the people who are coming to Yerushalayim, let's say, to be Makom Korban Pesach or whatever. They can already go to the mikvah over there before they already come into Yerushalayim. How did they solve the problem of the water that was smelly water? With the problem we mentioned before, the Gemara in Shabbos in the first parak, the water is smelly. How did they solve the problem so that the water should be clean? The method commonly used today is a concept called an otzar. It's a concept of an otzar, and we'll explain the concept. It goes like this. As we mentioned, the mikvah's got to be 40 seah of rainwater. 40 seah, meaning 3 cubic meters, and contains 40 seah of rainwater. Now, once you have 40 say of rainwater, no matter how much you add, no matter how much water you add to the mikvah, it'll still remain a kosher mikvah. Even if you have drawn water, even if you take water from your tap, from your sink, and put it into the mikvah will remain a kosher mikvah as long as you had originally 40 say of rainwater. That is the concept that based on this concept. What's done today is they have an otzer. The otzer is an area of 40 say of rainwater in which the people are not tovel. It's next to the mikvah. Most people don't even know it exists. It's next to the mikvah. Now, the mikvah itself is filled with fresh, clean tap water, which is not rainwater. It's already mayim shuvim. It's drawn water. So how does that become a mikvah? There's a hole that connects between the two. And it's usually corked up. And when they fill the water, they take out the cork and the water from the mikvah, which is the drawn water, touches the water in the otzar, and thus it all becomes a din of a kosher mikvah. That is what's done today, and that concept is called hashaka. Hashaka comes from the word from kissing, the shika, that was where the water and the otzar touches the fresh water, and this is how it's done, hashaka. That's commonly done today everywhere. In the old times, they had other systems which they also used, which we do not use today. One of the things could be is that they just poured fresh water into the mikvah until the water was overflowing. And that's how they switched some of the water. It's not a way to clean the entire mikvah, but it's a way to add fresh water into the mikvah. As long as you have the fresh water, you can continue you can continue using it. Indeed, in some of the mikvahs, they did find the concept of hashaka. In other words, we'll soon see if it was hashaka or not. But they did find the concept that next to the mikvah, where the people bathed, there was another storage place where there was rainwater. Of course, the water wasn't found, but you see, it was meant for water, and the two touch, and they have a hole in between, a masada that was found in numerous places. It was found in a mikvah in Herodion. In the old city in Yerushalayim, a couple of mikvahs were found like that also. Not everywhere. But what's interesting is that there's two ways actually of doing it. The way that's commonly done today is a concept, as I told you, called hashaka. You have the rainwater on one side, you have the people where the people bathe on the other side. You fill that with fresh water, and then they touch together, and that's how the mikvah is kosher. But there's another way of doing things, and that's called zriya. And in zriya, instead of the water going directly into the fresh water, instead of going directly into the mikvah where the people bathe, the water goes into the yotzar. And it fills into the yotzar, and then it overflows. And when the water overflows from the yotzar, it goes into the mikvah. That's a concept called zriya. Now, each of these systems, zriya and hashaka, they each have their advantages and disadvantages, and every place, whatever fits, they choose. They're both kosher, whatever, and that's not the issue over here. But the person by the name of Asher Grossberg, who did a lot of research into the mikvahs, he comes to the conclusion that all the mikvahs in the days of the second Beis Hamikdash, that we find these two things for water, an otzer and a mikvah, they all use the system of zriya and not the system of hashaka. Now, how does he prove it? Well, in Masada, for example, he looks at the watermarks that remained on the mikvah. The mikvahs were found to be dry, but there were watermarks in the height. Now, if you do hashaka, that basically means you have to fill up the mikvah all the way up to the hole, which connects with the otzer, and then the two can touch. Which means the water in the mikvah is going to have to be the height, at least, of that hole in the middle. Let's say the hole is a meter and a half high in the wall, then the mikvah is going to have to be full with a meter and a half of water in order to reach that hole and connect with the otzer. But if you do zriya, then what does that mean? That means you pour water into the otzer, and from the otzer the water overflows into the mikvah. Then you don't need the water in the mikvah to reach the height of the hole. It's enough that the water in the mikvah has 40 seah, even if it doesn't reach the height of the hole. So he proves from the mikvah masada, based on the water marks along the walls, that they use a system of zriya. Now, the water in the mikvah was very low. Why? Because they wanted to save water. So the water in the mikvah was very low, and the only way that it reached the hole was because it was overflowing from the hole and poured into the mikvah. So how are they tovled if the water was so low? So his conclusion is that they tovled lying down. Because there's no other way that a person can fit his whole body into the water when the water's so low. So he even tried it and worked out the whole system. He went into the mikvah to see if it fits, if it's possible. There's even a step over there that was shortened at a later period. And his conclusion is that they purposely shortened it so that the people could fit in, you know, and be tovel, you know, when it's when the water's very low. But that's his conclusion. But anyway, the bottom line, and he claims in Yerushalayim, until a little over 100 years ago, there was no hashaka in any mikvah. It was all done by zriya. Today, hashaka is commonly used. Some mikvahs have both hashaka and zriya. But he proves that the mikvahs then were done by a concept called by a concept of zriya, not by the concept of hashaka. Another interesting thing, which was found in one of the mikvahs in Masada, and in a few other places in the country, and one in New York City, is a person can really claim that the purpose of the mikvah is for personal hygiene. People went to the mikvah to bathe. But in New York City, for example, in a few places, they found a bathtub right next to the mikvah. In Masada also, they found a bathtub next to the mikvah. That's one of the pictures that should be going up. There's Rav Hashem, where you see a picture of a bathtub next to a mikvah. And if there's a bathtub there, obviously the bathtub is meant for personal hygiene, while the mikvah is meant for the ritual, for the spiritual bathing. So the fact that the two of them are together, then that's, that shows that the mikvah, again, was used for the spiritual purposes, and not just for bathing. What's interesting is that the most complete system of mikveh in the Jewish quarter in the Old City is in a section called T4. That's where they excavated, called T4, where they found a bathtub, and they found a bar, an otzar, and they found a mikveh. In other words, they found all three things together, which is the only place that was found in the Old City. But if you're going to go around looking for it, you will not find it, because 30 years ago it was buried temporarily underneath the parking lot in the Rova. And until they're going to make a new parking lot in the Rova, the Mayor of Yomenu, it's going to remain buried there. So you really can't see it, but you can see it in Nachman Avigad's book, The Upper City of Yerushalayim, that you could see it. But the complete system. But the fact, finding a bathtub, as I said, near a bathtub near a mikvah, is has been found in a few places. Hazman Katzer, I really want to touch on one more thing before. I just mentioned that the places in, two or three places where they found next to the olive press, they found a mikvah, and that's clearly the purpose for the people to be tovel before they work in the olive press. We have a mission in Tyrus, if a person takes workers and he wants them to be tarred before they squeeze the olive oil, so does he have to see that they actually tovel, or is it enough he takes them to the cave and can believe them that they were tovel, that they tovel? You don't find any such thing next to a wine press. Now, of course, in archaeology, what we don't find can have 27 different reasons. But one possible reason is, and an olive press is if we found by everyone, all they have is about 3-4 in the country where we have a mikvah next to an olive press. But if we do find, one reason could be, and that's the Gemara of Gimel and Beis and Psachim, where the Gemara talks about the Nehemiah, Bozer, and Betara. That's in source 4.1 Hebrew source page. Ve'ein Moskin Vitaro. In other words, why are they careful when they cut the grapes? They harvest the grapes, they're tar. But when they cut the olives, the people aren't tar. So in other words, what it means is that the moment the grapes are picked, they can become tummy, and therefore the person who picks them has got to be tar. But the olive oil, until you squeeze it, cannot become tummy. Let's not get into the reason why at this moment. Look at Rashi over there, etc. So therefore, if the person wasn't tar when he brought the grapes to the wine press, it's already too late. It's not going to help the guy to be tovel when he's pressing the grapes. But by the mikvahs, by the olive press, that yes. Interestingly, in one of the small cubicles near the Robinson's Arch by the Southern Wall excavations, they found remains of an olive press. It is kind of strange. In the middle of a city, to find an olive press, that's pretty rare. You usually find an olive press, you know, outside in the outskirts of the city, right next to the base of Mikdash, someone decided to make an olive press. But it could be that that's the exact reason. A person wanted to have tar olive oil, so this was his way to guarantee that it's tar. If, until you squeeze it, the olives cannot become tummy, if they didn't come in contact with anything. So here you squeeze it, you know that your olive oil is tar. So that's a very interesting thing. One more very important thing, which to talk about, is the concept of clay eved, stoneware. We have over here in the Hebrew source page 5.2, for example, Mishnah and Parah, in the third line it says, V'chosa shall eved be adam. All the work of the Parah Duma was done with clay eved. Why is it done with clay eved? Because clay eved, stoneware, cannot become tummy, because it's in the natural format. So when they worked with a Parah Duma, they worked with clay eved. But clay eved were not limited just to the Parah Aduma. In the end of the second Beis HaMikdash, the last 100 years, clay evens start popping up all over the country. In Jewish places, and places where there's Jewish population, there is clay evens popping up. It costs a lot of money to cut out a glob of rock and start scratching away. I have over here a whole book. I don't know if the video can get it. a whole book over here by an archaeologist by the name of Yitzhak Magen, who did his doctorate thesis on the clay oven and the manufacturing of clay oven all over the country. And here it goes to the details exactly how it was done, how they were manufactured, how the work went. Today we know a lot about it because besides finding the rocks themselves, they found two caves where the stuff was manufactured. So besides finding the cups themselves, they found the broken cups and they found the insides of the cups. Now it turns out that there were thousands of such insides of cups, which means the amount of stoneware that was manufactured in those days is without numbers, but it's a lot. And again, only two caves are found, but from those two caves alone, we know that a lot was manufactured. The concept of stoneware, again, is also limited to Jewish areas. Jewish areas, because no guy would spend money on a stoneware, it costs so much more than a piece of clay pottery, which is very cheap. But a Jew, who knows a piece of clay pottery, if it becomes tamei, the only solution is to break it. And if you live in Yerushalayim, and you're sometimes tamei, you're sometimes tar, and every time you start switching cups, you're bound to be destroying and breaking the stuff. So there's a very simple solution. Use something that cannot become tamei. Something artificial cannot become tamei. It's not artificial, it's just the opposite. It's purely natural, and that is the stoneware. So thousands of such things were manufactured. And what's important for us, and two things, and with this we're about to finish, the extent of Jewish population. As I told you, today they find the site, a mikveh is one of the things that gives us identification as a Jewish site. Another thing that will give identification as a Jewish site is the fact that there is clay evidence. If there's clay evidence, if there's a stoneware, we know it was a Jewish population. And indeed, if we take a map of the country, and we see where Jews lived during the Second Beis HaMikdash, and where Goyim lived, and we take a map of the country and we see where the stoneware was found, we'll know, we'll put together the things. So, not surprisingly, the evidence matches. Where we know Goyim lived, they don't find stoneware. We know Jews lived, they did find stoneware. But another important thing is, and that's the question of, what happened when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed? Now, at a certain time, we no longer have the ashes of the Paraduma, and we can no longer become tar. If a person's Tmei Macy, no longer can become tar. The question is, how long did they actually have the ashes of the Paraduma? The Gemara in Chulin tells us that Rabbi Amin and Rabbi Asi used to eat truma. Rabbi Amin and Rabbi Asi are ready in the beginning of the Eretz Yisrael Amorai, and they're still eating truma, which means even in their days, they still had the ashes of the Paraduma and were able to become tar. What does archaeology have to add to this? The Gemara Nida, and I have a quote here on the Hebrew source page from the Gemara in Chagiga. Source 3.3, Chagiga, the Chaverim, some people who kept Tumantara in the Galil, they would do things with Tara. The Gemara Nida tells us that they would bake bread hoping to use it for Lachmei Todah. Now think about it. Lachmei Todah. You know, as you bake a loaf of bread, how long is this loaf going to be edible? A few days, at best. And they're baking it betara, hoping that they can actually go and bring this loaf to the Beis HaMikdash and be makabel as a korban tzedakah. And likewise, they would make oil and wine, hoping that this oil and wine can be poured on the mizbech. So the Gemara tells us that in the days of Rebbe, which is already 130 years after the Churban, they are still preparing stuff betara, which means they definitely had the ashes of the eifah of the paraduma. So, likewise, in archaeology, although when this book was written, they still haven't found it, but in later years, excavations at Tzipori from the time of the Mishnah also show clearly that they found clay evin, a nice clay evin, meaning even 100 years after the Churban, they are still eating the stuff of Tara, they still had the Paraduma. Now today, and with this we'll finish, there's a race for the ashes of the Paraduma. In the copper scroll, which is found in Qumran, there's a list of treasures that are around. And one of the treasures is called a kalal. Now a kalal is a kli that was used also to keep the ashes of the Paraduma. So this non-Jewish Noachide, who recently accepted Sheva Mitzvah Menoch in the presence of the Sanhedrin, not far from here, has Wendell Jones. He is excavating to find the kalal, because he believes, and this is a guy, that the one who controls the world is the one who's going to have the Torah purification. And whoever finds that kalal he'll be able to get the purification. Now, he doesn't want it for himself. He wants it for the Jewish people. But that's his big search in the cave in Qumran. He's trying to find that kalal from the Paradum. The Pasuk says, we see that by Chizkiyo, he knew that the koyach, to be victorious, was the koyach of the Torah and the koyach of Tahara, purification. Even little children, they knew how to be careful to make sure that they're Torah. So, unfortunately, for a good 1600 years, we haven't had these halachas, but we really hope that in the near future,